Happy Chanukah, everybody. Our topic for tonight is the fifth Knesset election of 1961, which was the dirtiest of all the elections up to that point. There'd be plenty dirtier after that, because sometimes politics just descends into an abyss. But this one was pretty rough. Okay, now what was the context? From 2 weeks ago, the last time we met, we spoke about the second round of the Lavon affair of 1960 and 61, where Pinchas Lavon, who had been ousted as the defense minister in 1955 for his involvement in the episode of terrorism in Egypt in 1954, so he was rehabilitated to an extent and made the secretary general of the Histadrut. But new evidence came to light that would have exonerated him, and he forced it down the throats of the Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee, which was then leaked to the press. The Israeli public knew about it for the first time in almost all of its gory details, and the question is, will Lavon be exonerated by David Ben-Gurion? And Ben-Gurion refuses. He says it's not a matter for politicians to decide, it's a matter for judicial inquiry, which was not created. Yeah.
If he was exonerated, why wasn't the public seeking the responsible person?
Well, that's Ben-Gurion's point. But by exonerating one man, you automatically incriminate the other, and it's not for a politician to do that, it's for a court of law to do that. Why were they not looking to convict the other guy? The answer is maybe nobody needs to be convicted. It's a matter of having a political liability, not so much criminal liability. And the other guy wasn't a politician. He was a former army officer, Benjamin Gibley, who was off the radar at that point. So it was a ministerial committee of seven that ultimately decides the fate of Lavon, and they let him off the hook. Ben-Gurion doesn't like that. He resigns. When he resigns, the other members of government resign as well. Now, Ben-Gurion did not want to have a new election. He wanted to just make a show of force that he was dissatisfied with his colleagues and then reformulate a government under the existing Knesset, because the president of Israel at that time was Yitzhak Ben Zvi. So Ben Zvi would have allowed Ben-Gurion to form a new coalition. It proved impossible, and I'll explain why. You see, Ben-Gurion did not want a new election cycle, since the previous one had just been a year and a half earlier, and Knesset election cycles are supposed to be every 4 years. And it's a sign of an unhealthy democracy if you're calling elections all too frequently. I mean, they ask the Brexiteers about that now. They're going to have elections again. Or in Italy, they have elections every other year because they can't have a government that's stable. You don't want to have too frequent of a Knesset election. But why was it impossible for Ben-Gurion to reformulate the coalition? Because some of the members of the government, including Achdut HaAvoda, Mapam, the National Religious Party, all refused to rejoin a Ben-Gurion-led cabinet unless there was a new electoral mandate. Now, why does a coalition partner make such a demand? It's because they think they're going to do well in a new cycle, and they think the leading party is going to suffer a devastating blow. So new elections are in their interest. Therefore, they say, you know, we're willing to go to a government, but after a new round of parliamentary elections. You have that all the time, including right now in Israel. Okay, so if they're going to go to elections, then each party has to put forth some legislative agenda and some propaganda that will convince the voters to switch their allegiance from the previous cycle in the current cycle. And let's just look at the main advertisement of the Mapai for 1 second. It's just a big picture of Ben-Gurion. In other words, it's like a Stalin-esque type picture. The leader, Mao Zedong, could have been in that picture. I mean, it's just him with that smile on his face, with the workman's garb. And it says, very simply, HaShelton Baretz Demokratit, the regime in a democratic country, Ba Min HaAm, it comes from the people, Kayam Lan HaAm, it's for the sake of the people, Chozer La'am, and it goes back to the people, Nimsar Tamin Chadash Kif Pikadon, it's given periodically as a pikadon, not as a right, but as a deposit. But into those hands of the people who prove their worth. Meaning, it's like right out of Abraham Lincoln, government by the people, for the people, but it really isn't. It really is like a Mao Zedong-style advertisement with American-style propaganda on the other side, saying, you know, vote for us, we know what we're doing. We're the best at this. Okay.
Yeah. Is there ever a discussion of term limits?
No. 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 But, as we'll see at the end of tonight's session, whereas at the end of his first term of office, when he resigned to go to Stable Care in the Negev, people were clamoring for him to stay on. Don't leave us, dear leader. In 1963, when he goes the second time, they're kicking him out the door with 2 feet, okay? So, there are term limits in the sense of when we get tired of you, you're gone. All right. So, so, but his involvement in the government was negligible.
That's
negligible.
Right. He had no portfolio. Can you imagine that? Ben Gurion without a portfolio.
He was doing nothing. He was just there for the sake of being there.
It was window dressing.
Correct.
For NASA.
Correct. So.
Want to get rid of Netanyahu now?
Well, that could very likely happen. Now, the next ad from the Mapai basically said, "We're doing great things. Forget about all the political shenanigans and the problems that the leadership have, whether the cabinet ministers or the members of Knesset. Those are all like inside baseball kind of political problems. But the real fate of the country is a success story. And there are 4 items here. One of them is Ha'aliyah El HaMilyon HaShlishi, to the 3rd million, meaning the population of Eretz of Medinat Yisrael at that point was bordering on 2.5 million. And they said in the next half a decade we're going to approach 3 million. So we're doing great. The demographics are improving. Also, Hayarden LaNegev, the national water carrier, a picture of pipes, you know, big long pipes with water going to the Negev. And a few other things about how the countryside, including the Negev, is being settled, all because of the steady hand of Mapai leadership. So, you know, vote for the guys who know what they're doing. Now, the next ad, the last Mapai ad I want to show you for tonight, is has an unpleasant overtone in my mind. It says Sichat Nashim, two young girls basically talking to each other. Although I think they're supposed to be housewives. One dressed more demurely than the other. One in a 1950s outfit, one in like a 1970s outfit, although this was 1961. So Mapai had a history of including women towards the top of the ticket. And Golda Meir to this day is the only female prime minister of the state of Israel right out of the Mapai. It was long agreed upon that there is no gender bias in labor Zionism. Women can go to the very top of the list. But this ad was condescending towards women. And I'll read it to you. Not that it's the most important ad in this cycle, but I just want to show you how the world changes. It says, Sichat Nashim. One woman says to the other, Ulai at yodat, do you know what these parties want from me? Meaning they're all soliciting my vote. What do they want from me? So the other one responds, we women are just as important as the men. We have the freedom to choose our party of preference. We can determine the style, the nature of the government. We, the women. Have you decided who you're going to vote for yet? So the other one responds, well, I'll tell you the truth. I'm not interested in politics. So a woman is telling the other one, I'm not interested in politics. So the one responds, what are you interested in? Many things I'm interested in. Tanaya avoda, work conditions, dira, housing conditions, limudim, education policy, briut, health policy, kamavan, gam bitachon, and also security policy. So the other one responds, Habibi, mistabesh enach yod adisha klal klal. You're not apathetic at all. Bamat choshevet mitaskim agvarim. What do you think the men are dealing with? Harima shamrat hu haikar politika. Whatever you just said is exactly what politics is all about. So here the woman has all these concerns, but she doesn't realize that that's what politics means. So it's like the stupid woman who doesn't know any better. So there's a very condescending attitude in this ad, but it was put forth by a party that historically had been very fair in its treatment of women in terms of its position in leadership. So it's a very odd ad in my view, but it was designed to get the female vote, a disproportionate percentage of the female vote for Mapai.
Which of the two was the one who was ignorant?
So it's unclear.
The one or
no, because they're both pointing that way, so I don't know who is who.
Oh, too bad.
My question is, besides Golda Meir,
There was a time when I speak with more authority than that. What of a woman was there? Within the time frame when she came into the government as a minister, to the time that she left.
So, government ministers, there weren't, but members of parliament, there were.
I'm talking about government.
So, government, there was not. There were no other women.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Later on, in the 80s, there would be, and then certainly now. Okay. All right. So. Now let's go to the communists. Because the communists, although ordinarily I would ignore them as being basically irrelevant, they have what to say in this election cycle. And their goal is to undermine the Mapai and to undermine not just the political party of the Mapai, but its policy positions, especially with relation to Germany. Germany plays a very important role in the 1961 Knesset elections on a few fronts. One, arms sales to Germany. Two, diplomatic relations with Germany. Three, reparations from Germany. And four, the possibility of German citizens behaving badly in Egypt and facilitating the development of rocket technology. So, plus the broader issue of West Germany equals the West in the Cold War, and the communists are in favor of the Soviet position in the Cold War. So, there... they have a bunch of ads that I find interesting. One of them was, you have kosher. You have a Jew painting the word kosher on a German who has a swastika painted on top. Now, what is this all about? It says like this. Haim Yorshei Hitler yechanchu et morei Yisrael. Are the heirs of Hitler going to instruct the teachers of Israel? Hakalon olam shel Ben Gurion, the great embarrassment or disgrace of Ben Gurion's regime, hashalechet morim Yisraelim lamo Torah min ha-neo-Nazim v'Bonn, that Israeli educators and academics were being sent to Bonn, to West Germany, to get instruction. And so, of course, the communists don't regard West Germany as another Germany, as the new and improved Germany. They regard it as all a bunch of neo-Nazis. And Germany is to be rejected in any manifestation, no matter what. So, they conclude by saying, "Yoter communistim beKnesset, yoter sikul bitul ha'iskot hatzmeot im Yoshe Hitler." The more communist mandates we have in Parliament, the more likely we will be able to undo the disgrace of having relations, impure relations, tmeot, impure relations with the heirs of Adolf Hitler. Okay.
Sounds almost incestuous.
A little bit, yeah.
I thought the Soviets had been discredited by this point.
The Soviets had been discredited in the eyes of certain of the left-wing parties, notably Achdut Avodah and an element within the Mapam. However, the communists remain devoted to the Comintern and to the Soviet regime. However, you should know that in the next election cycle in 65, Maki would be discredited in the eyes of the Soviet Union because there'd be a break in the Communist Party, Raqqa. Rishimat Komunistit HaKharasha, the new Communist Party, would be recognized by the Soviet Union as the real Communist Party of Israel, and Maki would be seen as a bourgeois disgrace. Now why did that happen? Because Maki remained Jewish and Raqqa was mostly Arab, and the Soviet Union favored the Arabs.
Got it. Didn't the general Israeli public dismiss the Soviet Union?
Yes, absolutely. However, it should be noted that those Jews who survived the Shoah, and survived the Shoah in Eastern Europe or in Hungary, and who were liberated by the Red Army, always retained a soft spot in their hearts for the Soviet Union. Despite whatever bad things may have happened in the later years of Stalin, or for that matter under Khrushchev or the others, Brezhnev to follow, it didn't matter. I know good, devout Zionists who are alive today, who are in their 80s, who remember fondly the Red Army, because they were in Budapest in 1945, and forever the Soviet Union will have a soft spot in their hearts. Moshe Sneh was a general Zionist who all of a sudden became the leader of Mapam, who then left Mapam to join Maki, who then stayed in Maki even when Raqqa broke off. So Sneh long remained a devotee of the Soviet Union, but at the very end of his career had a falling out with them.
Did the issue of Soviet Jewry come up?
No, not just yet. It should have, but it didn't. Now, there's one last communist ad that I think is funny because it's a little ditty. It's a poem that they wrote, anti-Ben-Gurion. I'll read it to you in the Hebrew. Svivo balashim, bachirim uschirim, menagnunim afelim, chel gadol shel mishartim, kulam mechazvim, et hazaken mishabchim, hu chacham, hu navon, hu silek et lavon, hu gaon, hu shinbet, hu silek et sharet. So for those who don't know the Hebrew, basically it means everybody just kisses up to him among his apparatchiks, and they say how much of a genius he is, and there's a careful play on the rhyme. He's a Navon, he's a wise man, and he got rid of Lavon. He's the Shin Bet, and he got rid of Sharet. So all the doves, the dovish members of his cabinet, have been dispatched, and now he's just a belligerent activist who is doing all the wrong things. Okay. Not yet. That starts in 64.
So this is
61. There is still not yet much talk of the fate of Eastern Bloc Jewry. I mean, some Jews left Hungary in 56, and some Jews will leave Poland in 67, 68. And some Jews, but right, it's not yet a big issue. Okay, so the next party, as we go from the far left further to the right, we have Mapam. Now, Mapam's biggest problem was that they claim everybody else is becoming just materialist and bourgeois middle class Jews, and that the chalutzik spirit of Israel of pioneering has been lost or is being lost. Were they right or were they wrong? They were right. Today, what is Israel? Are Israelis getting their hands dirty? I don't think so. Not for the most part. So, but already in the 60s, this was becoming a trend, that it was no longer cool to go to the kibbutzim or the moshavim. You wanted to live in the cities and have the nice life. So, the Mapam has an interesting ad. It says, "Mi solel taderach laburganut." Who's paving the way to bourgeois society? And in the front, there's a steamroller that says, Mapai. In fact, Tzi'irei Mapai, the young people of Mapai, in particular Shimon Peres and Moshe Dayan, who are abandoning the cause of the kibbutzim and just looking forward to middle class and upper middle class Israel. Behind them is the Liberal Party, which really was the middle class party, or the economic elite party. And behind them is Chayrut, with Menachem Begin looking like a lunatic with a funny hat on. Okay, so in other words, it's not, in the eyes of Mapam, it's not the middle, the centrist parties and right-wing parties that are taking us away from the spirit of kibbutzim and chalutziyut, but rather the Mapai itself is a traitor to its own cause. And you know what? They're not wrong. Because Mapai was changing. They were no longer espousing the views of going off to the border regions and watchtower and stockade settlements that was long in the past. This is now the 1960s Israel, which is trying to emerge as a first world country.
It seems to be a nostalgic look of the way things were, and wanting to keep it.
And wanting to keep it that way, but of course it's impossible to keep things that way.
Things
change. Society changes. Not everyone's going to engage in agriculture or handicrafts. We're going to move into a service economy eventually. Okay, now we get to the Achdut HaAvodah. And this is my favorite ad of the night, because it's right out of the Barack Obama period in the United States. And what am I talking about now? It says, "Ata asita, lo miflaga velo manhig. Ata banita tamedina." What did Barack Obama say? You didn't build that. Remember, he said, "You didn't build that."
You didn't put that company.
Right. Yeah. The government arranged. Right. So Obama was giving like a left of center view of how society functions, and that capitalism or entrepreneurs are really not the creators of their own creations. Okay. So what the Achdut HaAvodah was saying is that the Mapai is making the Obama argument. Who built society? We, the Mapai, the apparatus of the party of government, did everything. You, the rank and file, you dug a hole in the ground with your shovel. But really, the Mapai, what is Israel, and built Israel. And what is Achdut HaAvodah saying? No! The Mapai didn't do anything. Mapai is an ephemeral thing. It's a political party. Who built the country? You, the people. Ata asita, each one of you, hundreds of thousands of you, with your own sweat and toil, you built the country. Now, that's a great ad, because everyone likes to be patted on the back and said, you yashikoyach, you did it, not some government bureaucrat. So it's a good ad. I like that ad. Okay. Now, The next three ads of Achdut Avodah also get to the heart of the matter, and I'm going to spend some time on it because it's important long-term when we discuss Shimon Peres. But one of them is, they put Lavon and Ben-Gurion superimposed on each other in an ad. Basically, don't forget the Lavon affair. Lest the Mapai try to move us beyond the affair, the parasha, don't forget it. And they're at each other's throats. That means that there's internal dissension in the Mapai. They're killing each other. So if they're killing each other, why vote for them? Why vote for the party that's, you know, at loggerheads with itself? Rather, you have other options. Other left-wing, left-of-center socialist Zionist parties. Vote for Tavav, Achdut Avodah. Now, the last two ads that they had are important because they attack two people, Shimon Peres and Moshe Dayan. We'll do Moshe Dayan first, then we'll do Shimon Peres and see how, although this is 1961, the same ad could have been written 40 years later. Okay? There's a common thread through the career of Shimon Peres, Alav HaShalom. Okay. Now, so Dayan, it says, Shalu oto shelot, you the voter, ask Moshe Dayan the following questions, meaning he's now the Minister of Agriculture and a former Chief of Staff of the IDF and all-around tough guy, thinks he owns the joint. So ask him the following questions. What role did you have as the Chief of Staff in ousting Lavon from the Ministry of Defense in 1955? Meaning, it's not for the military to determine civilian affairs. There's supposed to be civilian control over the military. The Secretary of Defense is in charge of the five-star general, not the other way around. And yet, the suspicion is that Dayan collaborated with the politicians while he was still in uniform in deposing the sitting defense minister. Next one. Ate odea mi odeda ta katsina bachir adoto akozevet neged lavon? Or ate glemihu? Do you know who committed perjury in the Lavon hearings? Maybe you know. Because in fact he did know. Next one. Me'olam wa'ita zakuk la'avodak David Parnes. Ketzar efo atam urashal atzmacha latif pitorei yi'ul la'avtalam et konenet. You never had to work for a living a day in your life. Meaning, you never had to have a private sector job. You were a military man who was paid by the government, and then you joined the Knesset. You're paid by the government. So you never had to worry about going hungry, because you didn't have work. So who are you to all of a sudden be a centrist or a right-winger on matters of the social safety network, where he came in like gangbusters saying what? That the Histadrut and the government welfare system was overly generous. He wants to cut back on unemployment insurance. Well, you never had a real job in your life. Okay? And this is right out of American politics today, where they make fun of the community organizers and like they never had a real job. There was a guy who was a congressman since he was two. Now, next one. Dr. Bader, Mecherut, Dr. Yochanan Bader of the Cherut Party, Hechris Yes Kirva ben Deotechel ben Deot Miflagto. Matar Mal Kach, you know, the Cherut member of Knesset says that you and him seem to get along on a lot of issues. There's a lot of commonality of your viewpoint. What do you have to say about that? Now, why does the Achdut Avodah mention that? Because there, in fact, was a lot of commonality between Cherut and Dayan. They're both activists. Dayan wants to take the sword to the enemy whenever he can. And Cherut, of course, is a belligerent right-wing party. Which is, by the way, why ultimately when the very first Likud government is formed, who is their foreign minister? Moshe Dayan. There is a lot of overlap between the policy views of Cherut and Moshe Dayan. So why is Achdut Havodah saying this? Because Dayan is running on the Mapai ticket, which is a left-of-center ticket. And they're basically calling out Mapai, saying one of your big guns, your young studs, your young Turks, is out of step with the left-wing voter. Out of step with the left-wing voter. Okay? Then, next one. Higdartet havoda parlamentarit kishtiate. You were dismissive of parliamentary work as easy as sipping tea, as drinking tea. How does that... Ketzabit yasheret hoda'atcha... Im hashkafa demokratit. How does that mesh with democratic worldview, lowercase d? Meaning, it sounds like you're an authoritarian who's dismissive of parliamentary politics, and that if you were to ever win, you'd be an authoritarian. And you know, we don't want that in this country. This is a democratic society. Okay. And the next few are about his role as the agriculture minister and killing 20,000 cows, which is of no consequence.
That Dayan was a
He was. He was imperious. Yes, he certainly was. But he never was in a position to wield that kind of power. He never really even got close. Because in 1969, when Levi Eshkol died, although he would have wanted to throw his hat in the ring, it didn't work out for him. Golda becomes prime minister because she's the compromise candidate between Dayan on the right side and Yigal Alon on the left side. Okay, now we go to Shimon Peres. And as I said, this ad was written in 1961, but it could have been written in 1971, 81, 91, 2001. 2011 even, he was still alive and president. Okay, the first one. Tishalut tol she'elot, ask him questions. Hayim nachon, is it true, shediburacha al haliyah miromania, gamu ben hayeter lafsakat haliyah ma'arzu, that you opened your mouth about Jews coming from Romania, and as a result of that, Romanian aliyah stopped. In other words, you spilled the beans on something that was a secret matter, and because it came to the attention of the public, the Romanian government had to shut the doors to emigration. So it's your fault.
What was the background on that?
The background on that is it's an Eastern Bloc country, and there was an element of Aliyah coming out of there. It was a trickle that was going out, but it did come to a quick halt. Is it fair to blame Shimon Peres? I don't know. I mean, the Achdut Avodah wants to for political gain. I don't know.
Because when he was in, the floodgates opened.
I'm not sure. I don't remember what year he took over. Next one. Haim Nachon, is it true that you sold weaponry, or you were willing to sell weaponry to the fascist dictator Batista in Cuba? That only because of exposure and protest by American Jews did you not do this. In other words, left-wing American Jews who didn't like Batista were aghast that you, Shimon Peres, were going to arrange Israeli arms sales to a dictator. Next one. Haim nachon shenechshalta bevechirot vada hametamedet shel veidat Mapai achrona vaklacha shedayan lachatz al Ben Gurion manita levada lamrod zur kishlanach. So is it true that you really failed to get on the Mapai list for the Knesset in their Central Committee elections, and you only got on the Mapai list because Dayan, your buddy, your partner in crime, pressured Ben Gurion to put you on the list through the fiat of the boss? In other words, that you can't win an election, and only by devious means do you get to rise to the top. Now, why do I say this could have been written in 1981, 91, 2001? Because did Shimon Peres ever win an election?
No.
Shimon Peres became prime minister in 1977 for 3 months when Rabin resigned over Leah's bank account. So he was acting prime minister very briefly. Then he was prime minister in 1984 through 86 because of a rotation agreement in a tied election with the Likud party, with Yitzhak Shamir. And Shimon Peres became prime minister a third time on November 4th, 1995, when Rabin was killed. But he never won an election. So he somehow rises to the top by other means. So this ad is making fun of him. You didn't even win in your own party, but the boss had to throw you a bone, and he put you towards the top of the list.
He always had a reputation
for backroom deals. Yeah. Okay. Then, a few more points. Haim nachon she sarat hachutz amdali pater bilal iskot haneshek she'asita lo yediata. Isn't it true that the foreign minister, Golda Meir, almost lost her job because of arms sales that you negotiated as a backroom deal without her knowledge? Meaning you, as the director general of the defense ministry, and then later as the deputy defense minister, were making foreign policy decisions and arrangements without the foreign ministry's awareness. So you're a sneak. You're a real sneak, and nobody likes you. And even your own party members are suffering the consequences of your devious behavior.
To which sales are they alluding?
It's unclear. But there were...
That he was not liked in his own party?
Yes. Okay. Haim nachon, is it true shemachad haneshech lerodan fascisti Trujillo, loyedet misar hachutz, that you sold to the Dominican dictator Trujillo without the foreign ministry even knowing about it? So all sorts of crazy things that he did. And why is the Achdut HaAvodah attacking, of all people, Dayan and Peres? Because they represent the future of the Mapai Party. All the older folks, the generations that's half a generation younger than Ben-Gurion, the ones who hope they're going to take over, so we're talking about Levi Eshkol, Golda Meir, Mordechai Namir, Pinchas Sapir, Zalman Aran, the older folks, they're going to come and go soon. Their time is running out. No, it's not running out so quickly, but their time is running out. The young guard is Shimon Peres and Moshe Dayan. So if we can undercut them, then maybe the whole Mapai can collapse. Okay.
These sound like very, very telling attacks on all sides.
Oh, sure.
Did they have any effect on these candidates personally as far as their career goes?
So the answer to that is, on occasion, yes. Sometimes the negative campaigning does get somebody removed from the top of a ticket, from the top of the list, and gets them bumped down, and sometimes even off the list altogether. But in the case of the Mapai, where they're going to win 40-some-odd seats every time, even if they bump you down a few spaces, you're going to retain your seat. If you're in a party that only is going to win 6 or 7 seats and you get bumped down, you could be out of a job. That's the big difference between the major parties and the minor parties.
They have a resort to dirty tricks and things like that.
I think
I'm sure there are things that we'll never know about. But the dirtiest of tricks actually happened in the 1980s. Once you get Shas involved and Aryeh Deri, then it gets really dirty. Like when in a few months from now, we'll discuss the 1988 elections and the 1990 coalition agreements. It stooped to so low as people going to the ceremony to sign the paper and waving the pen over the paper but not actually putting their name on it. And then after the ceremony was over, saying, "Ha! I didn't sign my name," and then flip to the other team. It was a Chabadnik who did that. Okay, Verdiger was his name. There was going to be a left-wing government in 1990, led by Shimon Peres, without a new Knesset election to undermine Shamir. But in the last minute, the Chabadniks didn't do it because the Rebbe said you can't have a left-wing government. The call came from Brooklyn that you can't do it. It's true. So. All right. Now let's talk about the religious parties for a second. Discuss the religious parties. The Poalei Agudat Yisrael had been members of the government in the previous round, and they would join this government too. But the Aguda proper did not. And this is a tkufa, a time in Israeli history when there was not a united Torah front like there is today, United Torah Judaism, the UTJ. But rather, the Poalei Agudah and the Aguda were two separate parties with different worldviews and different ideas about the legitimacy of participating in Israeli politics. So, the Poalei point of view was, we're going to get involved in every aspect of Israeli society and Israeli governance. The official Haredi point of view was, we'll stay out except for those areas that directly affect religion and the religious community. But that's not really what happens. In other words, the Aguda would say, we're going to recuse ourselves from a whole host of things, but then they wouldn't recuse themselves. And so the Poalei ran an ad. It said, Lahem hakol mutar. To the Aguda, everything is allowed. Meaning they claim it's not allowed, but they'll do everything behind the scenes. So it says like this. Lenetzig Agudat Yisrael, for the representatives of Agudas Yisrael, mutar haya lashet chamesh v'chetzi shanim b'mashallah. They were perfectly fine with sitting in the government of Ben-Gurion for 5.5 years. Really, it was 4.5 years, from 1948 to the late 1952, when Rabbi Levin and the others were in the government and held ministry positions. Az kizachur lo hayu chilulei Shabbat b'medina, lo chazir, lo misyon v'lo shilton kofrim. Az shaltat rab mashot v'kneset. U'matay tzkila ha'pornut ha'gdola. So, between 1948 and 1952, if you recall correctly, there was no pork in Israel, everybody kept Shabbos, and there was no problems religiously, everybody was very frum, right? And that's why Aguda was in the government. So it's a mockery. Of course, religious life was as bad then as it is now, and the government was as trafe then as it is now. So why was it kosher back then to be in the government, and now all of a sudden you're a shanda and a chepa if you join the government? What changed? That's the Paulet's argument, and it's a good argument. Okay. So potentially because of the surplus vote, you're right. Yes, definitely the case. So umatay tchila pronut. When did all the disaster happen? Keshenitzig polei agudat Yisrael tzaref l'mishlak liyatzeg at interesim hayitzudim shel hamonei am Torah. Everything went bad when the Poalei Agudah joined the government without the Aguda. That's when it all went wrong in the eyes of the Aguda. You guys did a terrible, disgraceful thing. Okay, but then they say, for the representatives of Agudas Yisrael in the city of Tel Aviv, it's perfectly permissible to Limsor ir bat shlosh meot elef ish to Mapai, to give over a city of 300,000 people to the control of the Mapai, meaning by not engaging in politics in Tel Aviv, where there was a substantial religious population at that time. I mean, later there wouldn't be, but in the 50s, Tel Aviv was a largely religious city. Okay, a lot of Hasidim. Hasidic courts were in Tel Aviv, they were not in Mea Sharm at that time. So you gave up everything to the Mapai. That's allowed? That's smart? That's good for the religious Jews? It's silly for the religious Jews. Okay? And for Agudas Yisrael in Jerusalem, Mutayel in Court Ira Kodesh HaMikdash, Yidushay Yerushalayim, Tumartaki Seishal Sgan Revi'i, so they were able to give up the control of the holy city to the secularists just for a token representation on a certain committee, meaning you were foolish that the Aguda made silly political calculations and gave over to the irreligious what could have been theirs. All right. Now, then, for the Agudas Yisrael, it's perfectly fine to badmouth us for joining the Histadrut. Okay? But they themselves called for joining the Histadrut. So yeah, when we did it, it was bad. When you guys called for it, it was fine. When we do it, it's no good. There's a hypocrisy left and right. So therefore, don't vote for the Aguda. Vote for the Poli Aguda. We are not hypocrites.
Those religious parties, were they as staunchly religious as they are now?
So the answer to that question is that they were just as frum in the 50s and 60s as they are today. The difference is that society wasn't as crazy back then as it is today. And the divide between secular and religious was not as sharp because the demands of the religious were not as onerous on the public. There was no draft exemption for Haredim back then. If you were in yeshiva, you didn't go to the army. But if you weren't in yeshiva, and most people weren't in yeshiva, you went to the army. There was no kollel lifestyle back then. People worked. Poel Aguda, you work. You're a poel. Okay. So the whole the macro problems that Israel faces because of Haredi non-participation in the workforce, in the military, and in general society was largely absent back then. So they were just as frum, but more reasonable in their demands.
Were they as impoverished as they are today?
No, not nearly the case. No,
they worked.
They worked. Everybody worked.
Were they called Haredi at that time?
No, for the most part, not. I mean, every now and then you see that term used, but it's not. It was not commonly used. Okay. Well, it was datim. Shomrei Torah. Shomrei Torah was a big one. Okay.
Yeah, but Netanyahu also was considered datim.
Of course. All right, so you had to draw distinctions, or not draw distinctions. Okay, now let's go to the Chayrut. The Chayrut, of course, is looking to attack everyone to the left of them, which is everyone. Okay? And their targets are carefully selected. On the one hand, they're attacking the Mapai because they want to win, and Mapai always wins, so you have to unseat the Mapai. On the other hand, their biggest competitor is which party? The old General Zionist Party, which doesn't exist anymore. If you notice, I haven't mentioned them tonight. Why? Because they merged. The progressives and the General Zionists merged to form the Liberal Party, Miflaga Liberalit. Now, liberal, not in the sense of like 2018 American liberal, but liberal in the sense of like 19th century British liberal.
Laissez-faire
capitalist economy and protection of private property, protection of the rights of the individual citizen against the intrusions of the state. Basically, capitalist economy, entrepreneurial economy, an investor economy, and libertarianism on social policy, with an attitude towards religion and state that was not to neither extreme. Okay, so first of all, let's look at how Chayrut attacks the Mapai. The first thing is, Shiltona shel Mapai aruka midai. Nice little rhyme. The rule of Mapai was too long. And what's the big word in the middle of this ad? Parsha. Not Parsha HaShavua, not Miketz, but Parsha equals the Lavon affair. Parsha is the code word for the Lavon affair. The affair. But the next one is an attack on another attack on Mapai. So like this, Hagidu lav latalu lav. Say no to Mapai's shenanigans. Before the first Knesset election, so you have a picture of Moshe Sharet and David Ben Gurion holding on to a wheel. They're driving the ship of state, and the ad of the Mapai was Tenu hageb yadaim neamanot. Give the leadership to trusted hands. Trusted hands. And the next picture is, right after the election, Ben-Gurion gives a big boot, like a chalitza boot, to the rear end of Moshe Sharet, and kicks him out of the government. So what happened to the good hands, the steady hands? Then, before the fourth Knesset election of 59, again, Sabavitachon, go forward in security, that Mapai equals security. And then you have a train derailment with everybody jumping off the tracks. Eifo Abitachon, where's the security? So that every time the Mapai has a slogan for being elected, what happens? It's all a bluff, it's all a big lie. That's the Cheirut argument. But their biggest competitor was the Liberal Party. So they have a car, like a convertible, and who's driving the convertible and at the wheel? Two guys, the heads of the Liberal Party, Pinchas Rosen, who had been the head of the Progressives, and Peretz Bernstein, who were the head of the General Zionists. And what happens? They don't know what direction they're going in. One is pulling to the right and one is pulling to the left, because in fact they didn't agree on everything. One was further to the left and one was to the right. And so what happens? They're going to run people over on the street. Everyone's running away. So this is not the way to go. This is uncertainty, it's chaos. Huh?
Cartoon.
It's their party is a cartoon. And by the way, the Liberal Party only lasted one election cycle, and it broke apart. It broke apart because it couldn't survive. There were forces pulling in different directions. All right.
How many votes did they get in this election?
Let's now go to who won. So here are the results. On election night, August 1st, 1961, Mapai won 42 seats. They lost 5. They went down 5. It's a pretty big loss. Why did they lose some seats? Well, they're in trouble. They have internal dissension. The Lavon affair hurt them. Ben-Gurion is no longer as loved as he once was. So they got down to 42. The Cheirut won 17, which was a break-even from last time, which is a big disappointment for them. They thought they were on the ascendancy, and they weren't. They just fell flat. The Liberals won 17, which was an improvement of 3, because the previous election, the General Zionists had 8 and the Progressives had 6. So that's 14. So together they won 17. They did pretty well for themselves. The National Religious Party, the Mavdal, won 12. They broke even. The Mapam, 9, broke even. Achdut Avoda, 8. They went up 1. The Communists won 5. They went up 2. The Aguda won 4. They broke even. The Apollo Aguda won 2. They broke even. And the Arabs won 4. The Arabs did very poorly. They only won 4 seats. This would change very soon, because one more election cycle and they would finally have real Arab parties. These were all satellite parties of the Mapai. In other words, bogus. It's a farce. They're really just in Ben-Gurion's pocket. But the next time around, they'd have their own representation. Okay, so who's going to go in the government? Well, Ben-Gurion can't form a government. Why not? Why can't he form one? Just promise people, this job and that job, this ministry and that ministry, and you get your 61 votes. Why can't he form a government? Any ideas?
He's old
fat. Huh?
He's old fat.
That's true. But what else? What's stopping him?
He likes to keep control.
He likes to keep control. Bingo. So they developed a club of 4. A club of 4. 4 parties that banded together before the coalition talks began, and they agreed among themselves that we're not going to agree to join the government unless the Mapai gives up control of the majority of the cabinet. In other words, there has to be a nice representation of Mapai in the government, but the bulk of the cabinet seats have to go to the junior members of the coalition. And the reason why is because unless the Mapai loses its majority in the cabinet, what will they do? They'll run roughshod over everyone else. That even though they'll only have 42 out of 120 Knesset seats, they'll have a majority of 7 out of 13 cabinet seats, which means they'll have a click ahead, a caucus ahead of time before the big meeting. All 7 will agree on something, and all of a sudden you have a cabinet majority and no other party was involved. That was Ben-Gurion's modus operandi for 13 years. And it was brilliant. It was a brilliant political strategy. But these guys now say, we're going to stop you from doing that. We won't let you do that anymore. Well, how many seats did they have?
They couldn't bribe them into...
Okay, so ultimately there is a bribe. The Club of Four had 46 seats. The Mapai had 42. In theory, the Club of Four is more powerful than the Mapai. But the problem is that the Club of Four cannot create a government without Ben-Gurion without including at its helm the Cheirut. And most of the Club of Four was unready to give control of the State of Israel to Menachem Begin, even though their goal was to oust Ben-Gurion. Putting Begin in control was too high of a price to pay. What do you think of that? too high of a price to pay. All right. Well, 16 years later, they pay the price. He'd become prime minister.
It was a different Israel
at that time. Yeah. So, Ben Gurion tries to form a government and he fails. And in September, he recuses himself from coalition talks. Instead, Levi Eshkol conducts the coalition talks on behalf of the Mapai with the proviso that he will not be the prime minister. David Ben-Gurion will still be the prime minister, but Eshkol will run the coalition talks. Why? Because Ben-Gurion is now despised by too many people in the political class. And Eshkol, ever the compromiser, okay, the man of good faith who can work deals...
What year was this?
This is 1961.
Was Eshkol a puppet?
Eshkol was nobody's puppet. He was his own man. He was an important person, a minister of finance, who did great works for the Yishuv and for early Medinat Yisrael, and would go on to be the prime minister, and is remembered unfavorably because of his conduct in the Six-Day War, but was a very important and prestigious individual in 1961. He couldn't give a speech. He stuttered, and that ruined it for him. He wasn't Franklin Roosevelt, what can I tell you? So, he wasn't Ronald Reagan either. All right, ultimately, the government is formed. And who was in the government? So, it was the Mapai with 42, the Mafdal with 12, Achdut HaVodah with 8, the Poalei Aguda with 2, and the Arabs with 4, for a government of 68 seats. 68 seats in the government, 4 for the Arabs, 2 for the Haredim, 12 for the national religious, and basically 50 for the left-wing Zionists. And this was not the government that Ben-Gurion wanted. He was disappointed in Eshkol for producing this government. And why was he so disappointed? Because he wanted a government with the Liberal Party. He did not want a government with the Achdut HaAvodah. And his reasons are the following. He was concerned, Ben-Gurion, that the Liberal Party, the old General Zionists, were getting closer and closer in orientation to the Herut, to Menachem Begin's party. And if they would both be in the opposition, the temptation would be for what? For them to merge, which ultimately happens, and is the seeds of the Likud party and the ultimate takeover by Menachem Begin 16 years later. Ben-Gurion foresaw what could happen if the center and the right remain together in the opposition. Gachal, correct. Gachal exists in 1965, the next cycle. So he preferred Achdut HaAvodah. Moreover, Achdut HaAvodah, if it were in the opposition, if it were in the government, he preferred the liberals over Achdut HaAvodah because he wanted to prevent a merger of General Zionist and Herut, but also because he was afraid that Achdut HaAvodah in the government would stop his German policy. The far left was angry with Ben-Gurion over a few things related to German policy. One, arms sales, as I mentioned before. Two, diplomatic recognition. And three, the nuclear project. Israel was getting help on the nuclear project from France and from West Germany. And France, after de Gaulle had an about-face in 1960 and favored the Arabs, France was sort of backing out of its commitments and would have to be forced to comply with those commitments later on with the episode of the ships of Cherbourg where they stole the ships in the late 60s.
1968.
Yeah. So, but West Germany was a more reliable partner with Kesef and with scientific know-how. So, if Achdut HaAvodah is in the government, they're going to get in the way of all that. Whereas Eshkol thought the exact opposite. Eshkol and Sapir, the party bosses, overruled Ben-Gurion. They wanted Achdut HaAvodah in the government because they saw that Achdut HaAvodah was successful at the polls and delivered a punishing blow to the Mapai over the Lavon affair and over the unpopularity of the German relationship. So what Eshkol is thinking is, we have to get our closest ally / adversary even closer to us, because if we don't, then in the next cycle, what's going to happen? They'll gain even more and we'll lose even more. And what's the ultimate goal? A united Labour Party. Meaning bring all the lefties into one united party. Would that actually happen? Yes. The Israeli Labour Party was established in 1968. when these mergers will be finalized. That's 7 years later. We'll get to that in a few weeks. But the Labor Party, you know, Avodah, the name of the party, Labor, as you're familiar with it, which doesn't exist anymore, it's now the Zionist Union or whatever they call themselves, but the Labor Party, which was around for 40 years, was established in 1968 because Eshkol wanted unity. And he feared if you don't join with them now, that unity will never come to pass.
So
Mapam joined the alignment in 1969, but never the Labor Party, and eventually Mapam is part of the group that forms Meretz years later. Mapam doesn't go out of business as a party until 1997, when it all the constituent elements of Meretz disappear and Meretz becomes a united party. But Mapam remained part of the alignment for a good 2 decades.
So Eshkol was correct and Ben-Gurion was correct.
No, correct, yes. Each one was right, but the only thing is you can only choose one course of action, mm-hmm. and Eshkol's course of action won the day. So who's in the government? Let's rattle off some names. Ben-Gurion's at the top, Prime Minister in Defense. Dayan remains at Agriculture. Education was Abba Iben. Abba Iben did not want the Education Ministry. He did not want it at all. Why did he have it? Had nothing better to do. He was waiting in the wings until what? Until when? Until Golda would resign as foreign minister, so good old Abba, Aubrey Eban, could take over the foreign ministry. It's the only job he ever wanted.
He was UN and US ambassador.
He knew how to be a diplomat.
That was his...
Eshkol remains at finance. Golda remains at foreign. Chaim Moshe Shapira of the National Religious Party is the interior minister and health minister. Now remember, why does the National Religious Party want to control the interior ministry? Because of who is a Jew. Good. Labor goes to Yigal Alon of the Achdut HaAvodah. Okay, he's a real left-of-center guy. He wants the labor ministry. Religions go to Zerach Warhaftig of the National Religious Party. Trade is Pinchas Sapir, who would later become finance minister after Eshkol. Welfare is Yosef Berg, the father of Avraham Berg. Yamach Shemo, okay. Not Yosef, Avraham Yamach Shemo. Yosef was a big rabbi. Transport goes to Achdut HaAvodah. Now, Deputy Education Minister, Kalman Kahana of the Pole Agudat Yisrael. The Aguda, Pole Aguda joins the government. The Aguda does not, but the Pole does. They don't get a ministry because they only have 2 seats. 2 seats is not a big enough deal to get a ministry, but you get a deputy ministry. Why education?
Didn't they have posts with Benjamin Mitz?
Not this time. On another occasion, they had postal services with Benjamin Mitz. It was. But why deputy education ministry? Because the Haredim have their own school system, the Chinuch Atzmai. And you need to have somebody, a friendly face in the education ministry, if you want the funds and the favorable treatment to go your direction. If you have just Abba Iben running the education ministry, a guy from Cambridge isn't going to be looking so fondly upon a cheder in Bnei Brak. All right? That's why you need to have Kalman Kahana in the job. And a few others, we don't have to mention their names. Okay. Now, in the few minutes we have left, what was the fate of this regime? Well, it didn't last very long. It lasted only 2 years, actually less than 2 years, from November 2nd of 61 until June 26th of 63. What happened on June 26th of 63? David Ben-Gurion resigned for the second and final time as prime minister. Why he did that, we'll discuss next week. But until we get to that point, let's analyze the nuclear issue. The nuclear issue was a big problem in the early 60s for Israel. The Americans were opposed to the development of Israeli nuclear power. And this was made perfectly clear by the Eisenhower administration. In its waning days as a lame duck president in the last few months of his presidency, he put forth very strict orders to crack down on Israel. And the Kennedy administration continued that same policy of being very much opposed to military usage of Israeli nuclear technology.
Excuse me, was that only Israeli, or wasn't it an American point of view not to have anybody?
It was an American point of view, except that outside of the club of the 5 major powers who were on the Security Council, Israel was the only one at that time that was making any real headway towards development of a nuclear weapon. So therefore, Israel is the target of everybody's wrath.
All this came from France or from West Germany?
The technology and the seed money came from France. Later help came, financial help came from West Germany.
But my point is, it wasn't Israel. It wasn't Israel. Had it been India first, or had it been...
It would have been anyone. Correct. Yeah, they would have been opposed to anyone. Now,
America knew about this nuclear program the whole time.
Yes. The extent of it, they didn't always know, because there was a lot of deception involved, including when inspectors would come, they'd be seen like a Potemkin Village kind of situation, where it was a fake, like right out of Blazing Saddles, where they knock it over, you know, it's a fake set. So they did that to fool the American visitors. Okay, now, what is the political alignment on the nuclear issue? So David Ben-Gurion made a lot of enemies during the Lavon affair, including from the professors of Hebrew University, who thought that Ben-Gurion was acting in a tyrannical manner and was becoming an authoritarian dictator. So which professors am I talking about? Well, most importantly for these purposes, Yeshayahu Leibowitz, Nechama's brother, okay, the professor of Judaic studies and of chemistry, and Buber, Martin Buber, who is a professor of philosophy. They are universalists, and they don't like militant Zionism. Leibowitz will later go on to say the worst possible things about the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and refer to the IDF in very unpleasant terms that I won't repeat. But on the other hand, he was a great Torah scholar, and I quote him all the time. So he was like a
tshuva.
He cooled down. It's true. He cooled down. But he was opposed to nuclear weapons because they could destroy the world. He was a peace lover. Well, the Achdut HaAvodah, they sided with the professors against Ben-Gurion out of convenience. The Lavon affair was tied together with the nuclear issue, in that if you hated Ben-Gurion because of his treatment of Lavon, his anti-democratic treatment of Lavon, then you'll hate Ben-Gurion over the nuclear issue too. Why does the Achdut HaAvodah oppose nuclear weapons? After all, they're activists. They want to run roughshod over the Arabs, and they want to conquer all of Eretz Israel. They're firebrands, militarily speaking. They're left, very far left, economically, in terms of socialism, but they're strong-willed when it comes to fighting. So why do they oppose nukes? You'd figure if someone's full of bravado and bluster, they want to have nuclear weapons too. No, the opposite is true. Why? Three reasons. One, it will infuriate the superpowers, and we don't want to infuriate neither the USSR nor the USA. Number two, the Arabs aren't rational players of game theory, meaning we the Jews are normal. Western civilization is normal. The Arabs are backward and not normal and cannot be trusted like the Soviet Union can be trusted in the Cold War of mutually assured destruction. If we have nukes, the Arabs will get the nukes. And who's to say they won't use them first? Even though we'll respond and everyone will die, they are irrational. Therefore, nobody should have nukes. Just conventional weapons and we'll hold our own. And number three, and this is the most important of them all, if we develop nuclear weapons, they will develop nuclear weapons. Which at that point means conventional warfare doesn't happen. Now, you would think, well, the end of conventional warfare is a wonderful thing. People, you know, the boys don't have to go to war and die. But no, the end of conventional warfare is a disaster for Israel. Why? Because we have the Auschwitz borders. We want more land. We're territorial maximalists, and we want the West Bank and Gaza, and even more than that. And if we can't have a conventional war, we'll never get those things. Now, that's a very militaristic viewpoint that you would never want to say publicly. You know, you'd get into trouble in polite company for saying such things.
This is before the Six-Day War.
Now, I'll tell you something. Let's stop the tape because this is off the record now.